Monday, June 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, searching for peace in Yemen.
At the end of the day, I don't think that this conflict is going to end until there's some kind of arrangement that will have the Houthis certainly abandoning the capital, Sana'a.
Also ahead, what to do about Sudan's president and his arrest warrants, plus chasing the perfect Mozart in Russia's Ural Mountains. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Yemen's warring factions are on their way to Geneva now for the first significant talks in the months-long conflict. The talks today, facilitated by the United Nations, will bring to the table Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels and the exiled government of President Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi. The Houthis took control of Yemen's government back in February, leading Mr. Hadi to flee to Saudi Arabia. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Iraq, about the mounting pressure being put on the two sides to come to a political solution in what otherwise appears to be a deadlocked peace negotiation.
There is pressure for a solution because, first of all, there is a tremendous humanitarian crisis involving many millions of people in that population, which is somewhere over 20 million, involving both long-standing drought conditions and the disruption caused by the fighting and the bombing. So there's a tremendous effort by the UN, by the international community. The question is, will the two sides agree to some sort of reasonable solution? I don't know yet.
They'll be holding what are called proximity talks. I know you're very familiar with that, but they'll be meeting in separate rooms with the hope that there'll be direct negotiations. How likely will they meet face-to-face?
Well, whether they meet face-to-face or don't, you saw in the Minsk negotiations that the Germans and the French facilitated, there are all kinds of schemes, if you will, that can lead to an agreement. The form, the techniques, basically are very varied. The key issue is there a will on both sides? The Saudis have to encourage their side, which is the legitimate government of Yemen, although the president is currently out of the country, to compromise. And the Houthis are going to turn to the Iranians. But the Iranians have got a weak hand because, in the end, the international community, if the U.S. supports the Gulf states, can isolate Yemen from Iranian intervention. It isn't Lebanon. It isn't Syria.
The U.N. peace envoy, Mr. Ahmed, said these are the start of what he called preliminary inclusive consultations. He also appealed for the participants to take part, quote, in good faith and without precondition and in a climate of trust and mutual respect. But I thought the legitimate government, as you refer to it, was suggesting that the Houthis have to pull back from seized territory.
Well, that's their demand. They basically would like the Houthis to return to their own territory, however one defines that. And at the end of the day, I don't think that this conflict is going to end until there's some kind of arrangement that will have the Houthis certainly abandoning the capital, Sana'a.
Who has the upper hand going into the negotiations?
On the ground inside Yemen with the fighting, the Houthis. In terms of the geostrategic environment, as long as the United States stands by Saudi Arabia, it's going to be the Gulf countries and the United States.
If there's no breakthrough, what happens, sir?
The fighting continues until the two sides realize that it makes sense to compromise. Again, Iran is key to this, and this is another one of the many tests that, we keep on seeing Iran face, and up until now, I haven't seen them do any of them in a fashion that would make people think that it really is a status quo country that wants to contribute to stability in the region. If it did, it would encourage the Houthis to stand down, get guarantees and of their security, of their own borders, an international force, perhaps, or at least observers to go in there, humanitarian aid, and a withdrawal.
Will these talks have any impact on the Iran nuclear negotiations?
Directly, no. Indirectly, to the extent some in Washington And perhaps a few in Tehran, but I would put my money on some in Washington, think that these nuclear talks are going to lead to a transformation of Iran towards a status quo country. I think that Iran's behavior, one way or the other, is going to either strengthen or weaken that assumption.
That's James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador to Turkey and Iraq, currently a distinguished visiting fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Over the weekend, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani warned world powers negotiating a final nuclear agreement to stop bickering over issues or risk missing that June 30th deadline for an agreement. Iran continues to balk on one issue that the U.S. and European allies who want inspections of Iran's nuclear facilities. Tehran says this could compromise the nation's state secrets. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says negotiators are in Vienna right now working hard on an agreement, and he plans to join the process.
I will be absolutely, fully, and totally engaged in those talks. I am now. I haven't missed a tick, and I'll be traveling over there at the appropriate moment in the next days in order to press forward at this critical moment of the negotiations.
Mr. Kerry was discharged from the hospital back on Friday following treatment for a broken leg that was suffered during a biking accident while on a break from the Iran nuclear talks in Switzerland. Still ahead on International Edition, the latest on the fight against the Islamic State. This is VOA.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit voanews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Also in the news, Kurdish militias closing in on an important Islamic State-held town in Syria that's near the Turkish border. Retaking Tal Abyad would cut off a transit and supply route for the Islamic State fighters. Thousands of Syrian civilians have fled that area, anticipating fierce fighting between the Kurds and the militants. Meantime, the ethnic tensions in Syria and Iraq appear to be undermining the effort to defeat the IS militants. VOA's Latza Hoc reports.
As Kurdish forces prepare a major offensive against Islamic State in Syria, hundreds of civilians are fleeing into Turkey. A Turkish official has accused the Kurds of driving out Arabs from the areas they capture. The United States supports Kurds in their fight against Islamic State, but is warning against sectarian violence. Meanwhile, members of the Druze minority in the Middle East have called on the international community to protect their brethren in Syria, where the al-Nusra Front recently killed 20 Druze villagers. Several groups fight Islamic State and al-Nusra Front in Syria, including government forces, but they also fight each other. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
And we turn now to my colleague Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Press Conference USA, for a further look at the ongoing and expanding crisis involving the Islamic State militants, often referred to as ISIS. She speaks here with U.S. lawmaker Congressman Ed Royce of California, who chairs the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
With growing tensions in the Middle East regarding the Islamic State militant group taking over parts of Syria and Iraq, we'll be talking with Congressman Royce about a range of critical U.S. foreign policy issues facing the U.S. Congress. Congressman Royce, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Let's start with Iraq. As you know, President Obama admitted earlier this week that the United States still lacks a complete strategy for training Iraqi forces to fight the IS militants in Iraq. And then he announced that he would send about 450 additional U.S. troops to Iraq to train, assist, and advise local forces in their fight against the so-called Islamic State militant group. What is your assessment of this strategy? Do you think the strategy is working?
Well, let me briefly explain two problems that I've seen so far. One is we do need an overarching strategy, and we really haven't had an effective strategy. But the second aspect of this is that the government in Baghdad really needs to work more cooperatively with the Sunni tribes that are fighting ISIS and with the Kurdish forces that are fighting ISIS. And I say that after multiple meetings with leaders of the Sunni tribes and leaders of the Kurdish Peshmerga that are carrying out a lot of they're taking the casualties. And they need to get some of the weaponry, such as artillery or anti-tank missiles or long-range mortars, to better protect and defend themselves. So that's one aspect of the problem. The other aspect is that the United States could do more in terms of the use of our air power and have, you know, some of our people forward deployed as spotters to call in the airstrikes against ISIS, you know, embed them with the Iraqi forces. That will make it more effective as well. So my hope is that we have a combination of both better participation out of Baghdad with giving the resources and working more closely with the Sunni population and Kurdish population, and second, better engagement on the part of the United States in terms of helping on the airstrikes that are needed for air cover when Iraqi forces are battling ISIS.
Let me pick up on one of your comments, which is to help the Sunni forces, the Sunni tribal groups and Kurds. Some analysts say that we need a better political strategy because this is not... That is, the Islamic militant group, the Islamic State, is not going to be defeated militarily, that we need to help the Iraqi government, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, to be more inclusive with the Sunni tribes.
That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. So this is political, though.
It is political, and they failed to do it over and over again. Now, the current government is better than the prior Maliki government, but they still have a long way to go to really be even-handed on this. Second, we could have been more decisive in the early days of this air campaign when, obviously, you had ISIS leaving its compound in Syria and going over the border into Iraq. We should have hit these ISIS fighters from the air at that time, and there were many who called for that action to take place.
We're
finally doing that in Syria and, you know, before they took cities like Mosul. Right? There was a call for them to do that before they took Fallujah for the use of air power. Now, I'm sure this is more complicated than it seems at the moment to you and me, but it is clear that two things have to happen, and you've just identified, you know, the fact that Baghdad needs to be equitable in its treatment of Kurds and Sunnis, and inclusive, as you said. That is absolutely right.
Indeed, and as I said, analysts are saying here in the United States and elsewhere that it is the United States government that could be placing more pressure, notwithstanding the challenges on Haider al-Abadi and other politicians in Iraq. So from your perspective, do you see that happening?
As chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, that is what we're doing. The way I'm trying to do it is to say, look, if you won't transfer weapons to the Kurds so they can defend themselves, or if you won't transfer the weapons to the tribes that are fighting ISIS, you know, in Anbar, then the United States will do that. And we've got to say that to Baghdad. We've got to say, you must do this, because they're the ones taking the casualties out on the front line. You've got 180,000 Kurdish Peshmerga. 30% of those fighters are female, are women. And they're down there with nothing more, you know, than small arms up against ISIS. They deserve the weapons that they're asking for to help them defend their positions.
And we have not yet mentioned the Shiite militias, which are now at the forefront of fighting ISIL. And that causes another problem, as
that
you know.
That creates blowback. And that's why the work needs to be done, you know, and that's why the training needs to be done in terms of the Sunni tribes and in terms of the Kurdish forces and in terms of integrated Iraqi brigades rather than Shia militia coming in, you know, with the influence on Quds forces from Iran. That's a non-starter in these regions, and it just creates blowback and complicates the problem.
And as U.S. Congressman Ed Roy speaking with my colleague Carol Castiel, who is host of the VOA program Press Conference USA. This is VOA's International Edition. Also making news, at least 11 suspected Somali-based Al-Shabaab militants were killed. It happened in a dawn attack on Sunday on a Kenyan military base in Lamu County. Two soldiers also killed. The latest attack came as the country prepared to mark the one-year anniversary of two attacks in the town of Mpeketoni in Lamu County, in which militants killed more than 60. Al-Shabaab, which seeks to overthrow the Western-backed Somali government and impose its strict interpretation of Islamic law, has frequently targeted neighboring Kenya, saying it is retaliating for Kenya's participation in the African Union peacekeeping force in Somalia. In the group's deadliest attack to date, four gunmen killed nearly 150 people, most of them students at a university in Garissa, back in April. Libya's internationally recognized government says a U.S. airstrike has killed a top al-Qaeda terrorist wanted for a deadly attack on an Algerian gas plant in 2013. They identified the target as Mokhtar Belmokhtar, leader of a group called Signed in the Blood Battalion. He was killed Saturday in eastern Libya. U.S. Defense Department is only saying the airstrike was successful. U.S. State Department had posted a $5 million reward for Belmokhtar. He's accused of leading the 2013 terrorist attack on a gas facility in Algeria that killed 37, including three Americans. Libya has descended into chaos, as we've reported many times, since a NATO-backed revolt unseated longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011. Jihadist groups have exploited the lawlessness there. Washington has deployed drones to strike targets in the region before. A South African court is expected to rule today on whether Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir in South Africa to attend an AU summit should be handed over to the International Criminal Court to face charges of crimes against humanity. Sunday, a South African judge prevented him from leaving the country. In Khartoum, Sudanese Foreign Ministry official Kamal Ismail said the court ruling had no legal value and his government was assured by South Africa prior to the visit that Mr. Bashir would be welcome and was expected to return to Sudan on schedule. Foreign Affairs Minister Ibrahim Al-Gandour echoed this view in Johannesburg.
President Bashir is participating in this summit on an invitation from the AU and a welcoming reception from the government of South Africa. And as you know, that the summit, the African Union summit, has always been against ICC and its indictment to African presidents, including President Bashir. President Bashir is here to participate in the summit. He will stay until the end of the summit and leave on the scheduled time.
Despite calls for his arrest, Mr. Bashir took part in a group photo with other African leaders at the summit in Johannesburg on Sunday. South Africa's ruling African National Congress party said it was calling upon the government to challenge the order against Mr. Bashir, citing immunity that was granted to all participants of the summit. ICC has charged Mr. Bashir with war crimes and genocide for sending the army and backing Arab militia to put down an armed uprising in the Darfur conflict in 2003. UN says fighting in the impoverished region has killed 300,000 and created more than 2 million refugees. Most of the victims were civilians. The bodies of 18 West African migrants apparently trying to reach Europe were found in the Sahara Desert near Arlit in Niger. The 17 men and one woman represented at least eight countries, including Mali, Senegal, Ivory Coast, and Guinea. They apparently lost their way in a sandstorm before running out of fuel. They are believed to have died of dehydration on or about June the 3rd. An official of the International Organization for Migration warned the tragedy is indicative of the difficulties thousands face in their search for Libya to begin with and their often perilous journey by water to Europe. And it is time now for our look at the world of social media. And Michael Lippin is here to tell us about a groundbreaking space mission that appeared to have been lost but now seems to be back in business. What's the story there, Michael?
Hi, Steve. Yes, that space mission by the European Space Agency made headlines last November when it became the first in history to successfully land on a comet. The washing machine-sized lander, called Philae, settled on Comet 67P and transmitted data to Earth for only 60 hours before switching off when its battery ran out of power. It rather unluckily landed on a spot that was blocked from the sunlight that it needed to recharge its solar-powered batteries. But the scientists behind the mission never gave up hope that as the comet moved closer to the sun, Philae could someday be exposed to the sun's rays and wake up from its slumber. Well, the world found out on Sunday that Philae had in fact woken up when its Twitter account sent out this message, "Hello Earth, can you hear me?" So not only does Philae have its own Twitter account, but its handle, @Philae2014, is being followed by more than 416,000 people. And its first tweet since last November has been retweeted at least 27,000 times. Now, the spacecraft that sent Philae to the comet and that's been orbiting that comet ever since, called Rosetta, also has a Twitter account, believe it or not. And the people running the two Twitter accounts were in a playful mood, engaging in a cute little conversation, which went like this. Philae tweeted, "Hello, Rosetta, I'm awake. How long have I been asleep? Hashtag life on a comet." Rosetta responded, "Hello, Philae, you've had a long sleep, about 7 months." Scientists say Philae's first transmission sent data to Earth for 85 seconds, They're now planning to change Rosetta's orientation to point more directly at the lander so that the two can communicate more easily. Steve?
Many thanks, Michael. In addition to all those crazy out-of-the-world Twitter accounts, you know, we have a new one. It's for this very program. It's called @VOA_IE. You should check it out. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us here in Washington. In the news, as Russia's political relations with the West have deteriorated over the crisis in Ukraine, some are looking to cultural cooperation to help fill that void. Take the story of Theodore Kourentzis, a Greek-born conductor who has made Russia his home since the 1990s. Kourentzis is now leading an international cast in Russia's Ural Mountains on an improbable journey, you might say, recording the perfect Mozart opera. Charles Maines files now from the Ural Mountain city of Perm.
Theodore Kourentzis doesn't follow the standard career path of the contemporary classical music scene. The 42-year-old conductor left Western Europe for Russia in the mid-1990s. He prefers jeans and combat boots to stuffy suits. So maybe it's no surprise that Kourentzis left the famed opera houses of Moscow and St. Petersburg for Perm, a city on the edge of the Ural Mountains known more for Soviet prison camps than soaring oratorios.
It's like a monastery. Perm, for me, is the place that I can isolate myself from the unimportant part of the career and create the most important thing that I can create like an artist.
Kourentzis' signature project is a cycle of recordings for Sony Classical of the operas Mozart wrote with librettist Lorenzo de Puente. His Nozze di Figaro, or Marriage of Figaro, came out in 2014 to rave reviews. This year saw the release of Cose fan tutte, and the third and final recording, Don Giovanni, will be issued next fall. Kourentzis says his recordings rescue the works from flawed interpretations that rob Mozart's music of its subtlety, passion, and power, turning one of the world's great composers into a slick and safe choice for shopping malls and business centers.
What is our mission? To make a music for a restaurant or a bathtub, or to serve the composer? And it's really difficult to achieve this result. And I tell you, in a regular recording, the compromise and one of the first three takes will be, oh, that's fine, we finished.
Sony has built the Perm Mozart recordings as no compromise, as in no time or expense spared. And that commitment was on full display when an international cast gathered at the Perm Opera House to record Don Giovanni last fall. Sessions stretched 10, 12, 14 hours or more, with take after take after take. Canadian soprano Karina Galvan said she could handle the workload, but the late nights were another issue altogether.
You know, we start in the afternoon, but, you know, I'm sleeping till 11 o'clock, which is something I never do at home, but it's a nocturnal process here in Perm.
but not everyone was as giddy.
This is not normal what we are doing.
Kurenzis had German singer Simone Kermes run through more than 50 attempts at one short passage from her role as Donna Anna.
Of course, Mozart is difficult to record, and what Theodore wants, it's like over what human being can do. If you are not a computer, he has no respect of the singer.
Driving Kurenzis' musical vision and legend is his hand-picked Russian orchestra, Music Interna. They're known for a dedication to music that borders on extreme, admits the group's first violinist, Afanasy Chupin.
Oh, for me, it's very simple. I wake up every morning, I come to the theater, and I spend all my life here.
When Kurenzis arrived in Perm in 2010, he made a deal with the region's liberal governor in exchange for a promise to help transform Perm into the Salzburg of the Urals. But that vision for Perm looks increasingly out of step with the conservative politics of the day. The liberal governor is now gone, dismissed by Vladimir Putin. Local bureaucrats are threatening cutbacks and want a say in what Kurenzis stages. Last year, the Ministry of Culture even issued a formal policy paper saying Russia is not Europe, a position Kurenzis, who took Russian citizenship last year, rejects outright.
I don't think that there is a country that can exist without the influence of the East and without the influence of the West. This is one world with one electricity.
And with an acclaimed international cast pursuing perfection in one of the most unlikely of places, that may just be a dream worth chasing, no matter how many takes it takes. Charles Maines for VOA News, Perm, Russia.
And if you find yourself in Perm, you know what to do. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against ISIL will be long, but if the coalition remains united, determined, and focused, it will ultimately succeed, said U.S. Undersecretary of State Antony Blinken. Some gains have been achieved in the last 9 months since the coalition has come together. ISIL now controls 25% less territory in Iraq than it did when the fighting first started, and ISIL has lost significant numbers of men and materiel. At the same time, the coalition partners acknowledge that ISIL remains resilient, ruthless, and capable of taking the initiative, as they did in the capture of Ramadi. We have to learn from and act on such setbacks, said Undersecretary Blinken. In Iraq right now, we have the right strategy, a combination of coalition airstrikes, training, equipping, assisting, and effective local partners. As for Iraq's part, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider Abadi has laid out an effective military and political action plan for his country. It calls for accelerating the training and equipping of local tribes in coordination with Anbar authorities, streamlining the provision of weapons, expanding recruitment into the Iraqi army, recalling and refitting the local police, supporting a development fund for stabilization to get immediate assistance to areas that are cleared of ISIL, and ensuring that all forces in Iraq act under Iraqi command, a critical element of the plan to ensure accountability and a unified approach in the fight against ISIL. One immediate step that the U.S. is taking is to ship anti-tank rockets for use against the kind of suicide vehicles that were deployed in Ramadi to such terrible effect. Also, the U.S. is doing all it can to aid the region's millions of refugees and displaced persons from both Syria and Iraq. The United States has provided $3.7 billion in humanitarian aid to those affected by the war in Syria. And since the start of fiscal year 2014, more than $407 million for displaced Iraqis. The U.S. and its coalition partners remain determined to defeat ISIL, ultimately creating a future of opportunity and peace for people in Iraq, in Syria, and indeed in the entire region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.